It was originally written for smart cards and tokens. So if you take a smart card through, it's actually pretty darn straightforward. If you're Cisco and you take a Cat 6K switch that has all sorts of different pluggable line cards, some of which do encryption, some of which don't, how do you validate that? It's a total pain, right? Because that's not what the standard was written for. There are some ways to make it a lot easier that we'll talk about later in the day, but suffice to say, sometimes it's not completely cut and dry.
So the whole reason that we go through FIPS 140 is this.
So there was a policy that came out in 2001 called NISTISSA 11, which is National Systems Telecommunications Information Systems Security Policy. Say that. Everybody, now go. So this is a policy that came out in 2001 that basically said for any COTS, commercial off-the-shelf, information assurance and information assurance enabled products that are used by federal, they have to meet FIPS 140 or common criteria, whichever is applicable, right? So this came out 2000 and they started, I remember the RSA conference, the guys were running around throwing this on all the vendors' booths and we were like, oh, holy shit, what does this mean? And the reason we said that is because this whole IA enabled thing, right? So FIPS 140 used to just apply to like smart cards and VPN routers and things like that, right? Really hardcore crypto devices. Well, now we started having federal agencies go through and take this IA enabled thing and says, well, if you have a username and a password, that's IA enabled, right? That's an information assurance product. If you're doing SSL for, communications under any circumstances, that's information assurance enabled. If you have an access control list, that's information. So then it started applying to a whole bunch of different broad range of products, right? Anything from like network management to just about anything can go through a FIPS 140 validation now, as long as there's an underlying crypto lock. So where does it fit? Frankly, it fits everywhere, right? So a lot of people say, okay, well, I've got a product, but let's use this example. We're talking about a company that had a some wearable devices, right? And said, well, that doesn't really apply. Sure it does. If you've got health data on your super cool iFitbit or whatever the hell it's called, there could be some pretty sensitive data on that, especially as you look at really hardened medical devices that people wear or plug up or however that stuff works. There can be some very sensitive data on that all of a sudden needs to meet HIPAA requirements, or if it's deployed by Veterans Affairs, then it needs to meet FIPS 140, right? It can go on the mobility side, right? So that's something that we've seen a ton of interest in. And as all this data is going between wearable devices and mobility devices and just all over the internet, it needs to be protected, right? So FIPS 140 certainly applies to products that are pushing or pulling data in motion, right? But also data at rest, right? So if you're in a cloud environment, if you're in some super secure server, or if you've got file storage on your phone. One of our customers has a file vault locker thing on app. All it does is encrypts data on the phone at rest. It doesn't transmit any data, but they need the FIPS 140, right? So it applies wherever you're encrypting data, whether it's in motion or at rest. Does that make sense so far?
Of communication between hardware devices to data within them. But what if the crypto itself was implemented in software?
Sure. Okay, so the question is, it seems like it applies to hardware-to-hardware communications, but what if your implementation is in software, right? Still
Like virtual editions. Nowadays we have virtual devices.
actually, from what we've seen, most stuff is moving to software and moving to virtualized environments and moving to a lot of, you know, software-defined networking, you know, all this stuff, right? Where software does seem to be kind of the path where folks are heading. Or you can have a hybrid model, right? Where you've got a box that has both an ASIC and a software implementation that do different things, right? So the ASIC might be doing bulk encryption for, you know, for you know, like a bump of the line encryption type of thing. And the software side might be for the management piece. So we see a lot of that stuff as well. Both equally applicable, right? So you can target FIPS 140 for both a software module in that case, or the software aspect, as well as the hardware aspect, or even both, right? So you could combine them into one, what's called cryptographic boundary that Mark will talk about, and that could be your validation. So you can have both of those in one, or you can do them separately. But both applicable. So the levels of requirements. There are four levels of requirements, like I said, and they're progressive, basically, right? So what that means is, if you've met level two, you've met the requirements of level one plus a few additionals, right? If you've met level three, you've met level one, level two, and a few other things. Now, there are a few cases, and Mark will talk about this, where, you know, level three requirements might, you know, supersede a couple of different things and all that. But it is kind of a progressive step up. So what that means is, level one, it's no picnic. I mean, there's a lot of value in level one, and from what we've been talking about in terms of customer requirements and market demands and things like that, level one is usually pretty solid. I mean, there was a time where, you know, the Army was requiring at least level two on every device and level three on wireless stuff. Like, it got a little out of hand, and what they did is they kind of limited themselves in terms of products they could deploy. But now, I mean, it seems like, you know, sometimes people will say, I don't want level one, that's the easy one. I want to go for level four. Don't do it. Just don't do it. And next slide, we'll talk about some ways of deciding which level to do. But the important thing is that the requirements do build on each other, and level one really is no big thing. It certainly is valuable.
The standard itself,
like we'll talk about in a minute, is broken into different categories of requirements. So there's things like self-test and key management and roles and services and authentication and interfaces. Well, each one of these sections has its own set of requirements, and each one of these own sections gets its individual level. So what that means is, to make things a little bit more complex, you can be FIPS 140-2 level 1 validated with level 2 for authentication requirements, right? So sometimes people will do that. There's not usually much of a customer demand for that, because frankly, sometimes from a procurement perspective, people don't always understand, right? They'll say, we need that fifth thing. Okay, well, we got that fifth thing, right? Where that will come into play, sometimes it's an easy win, right? So some products just have that level two functionality for, you know, authentication already there. So why the hell not have it in validation, right? Again, maybe they're playing leapfrog with a Juniper or a Cisco or something. So they might look for those little you know, bonuses where you can get the sales guys who, let's face it, aren't always, you know, as up to date on some of the technical things that they show. They're just, you know, trying to make their number for that week. So you can have a sales guy that's just looking for any differentiation he or she can to make a sale, right? And you want to give them those tools. So you want to say, all right, well, you know, if Cisco's doing this, well, let's go hit them with this, right? And again, it kind of comes down to preaching the value of FIPS 140 and the value of you know, level ratings and things like that. But anyway, that's kind of where that stuff heads. So as we start to go through the technical requirements for each section, Mark's going to break down the differences between level 1, 2, and 3 for each section, right? So when you're sitting there, you can think about your product, you can think about your system, and say, okay, well, I wonder if mine does this. So, and that's Mark. He knows everything about this.
stuff. Any questions so far?
What are the other sections you can think of? You mentioned key management.
Oh, there's a ton of them. We're going to go through them. We've got 2.5 hours left here. We're going to get into this stuff like you would not believe.
Yes, ma'am.
Sure. So think about it this way. There's 11 different categories of requirements, 11 different sections. To pass FIPS 140, to get a validation, you need to meet at least level one in each section. Except for one at the top. So you need to meet level one in each section, okay? But there are a couple cases where you might be able to meet level two for a specific section. So I think it'll make more sense when we get everything laid out. But you know, for example, the authentication requirement I mentioned. A lot of products already have that functionality built in. Like level one has no authentication requirements, right? So if your product has some sort of authentication that you want to include in that validation, then it's actually pretty easy to check off level two for that. And there might be some reasons to do that.
Does that mean?
Yes. So on the actual validation certificate, so at the end of the day, you get this, you know, little kind of group thing, and it's listing on the website, which, you know, we should have done a screenshot of that, but we can pull it out at one point. But yeah, at the end of the day, you get posted on the NIST website, and your validation certificate number, you know, point of contact, what the product is, what the version was, and what level you received, right? And in that listing, it'll say with level two for authentication. So it is like publicly recognized. Sure. Yes, sir.
So I get that FIPS was started as a US and Canadian effort.
Mm-hmm.
Is this being used internationally elsewhere? And are there other international maybe standards comparable to this, like in Europe or in Asia?
Really good question. Okay, so is it formally recognized as heavily as it is in the United States?
No.
Definitely not. There's some odds and ends where a long time ago I worked with the Italian government, for example, that was, you know, they were building out a system and they wanted FIPS 140. Because it kind of is a, you know, it raises the bar for the types of products they'd be able to deploy, right? It weeds out a lot of, you know, fly-by-night stuff. So they wanted FIPS 140 for that reason. Japan for a while was running the JCMBP, which was like this kind of an offshoot of FIPS 140 for the Japanese government that was similar enough, but they had a few different things. I don't even know what happened.
Is
that still okay?
Yeah, Daniel's here from the
JCMBP. Oh, awesome!
In Japan, not FIPS 140, but the international version of FIPS 140, ISO 19790 is required.
Awesome, okay.
ISO 19790.
So I mentioned earlier the dash two, and how we've been stuck on dash two for a long time, to make things equally as confusing. There's this concept of an ISO FIPS to make things kind of standard across, you know, the world, right, under ISO standards. So there's been kind of this push to move everything to an ISO level FIPS. I don't know if it's going to happen or not. I just stopped tracking it. It's different every other month, and we'll see what happens. It's out there, but we're not seeing a whole lot of requirements for it. We're not seeing a federal push for it yet. Maybe some new news will come out this week. So that's kind of one of the things that I want to see is that's always one of the questions at these conferences, right? Okay, what's next, right? Are we moving to dash three? Are we moving to ISO? Are we moving to dash four? Have you heard of that? So
let me make this back. 140-3 is towards the ISO version.
Right.
It's
been coming for 12 years.
Well, it's coming this year.
This year it's different.
No, I get cynical about that stuff sometimes. Well, it's just hard because as a product vendor, right, you want to plan for the best and the latest. And this stuff, like I said, isn't easy. And so when you go through and do it, you want to do it right. So that's a question we've gotten, frankly, quite a bit over many, many years is, what about S3? Well, I understand if you want to plan for that, but right now it's really not on the table, so let's not worry about that.
Is ISO FIPS formulated in Europe on the basis of FIPS developers ISO FIPS?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely built like a, you know, just any other ISO standard, just with kind of the FIPS 140 requirements imported in there, and then there's a whole process around it. I think there'll be some discussions around ISO FIPS. I don't want to spend too much time on it today because I think it just confuses the matter a little bit. But so, and frankly, anything that we talk about here will apply to ISO standard.
All right, so. How do I decide, or how do you decide, what level to go for? Like I said, it seems like, you know, kind of starting out, everyone wants level 4 just because it's the best, the highest, the coolest, you know, that's where all the James Bond physical security stuff is, right, with the lasers and the sharks and all that stuff. Not really. But this kind of economics 101 slide that we put together, what we tried to do here is basically illustrate kind of the value of the level ratings versus the complexity for them, right? So the reason that the value starts so high on level 1, like I said, is because level 1 is not easy, right? It seems like it should be a no-brainer, but it really isn't. And frankly, level 1 gets you to the table in most, you know, procurement situations. So there's an extremely high value in level 1. There's sometimes an increased perception for level 2 as well, especially for some hardware devices like, you know, routers or what have you, but not always. But then as you start to get to level 3, what happens is these products become so locked down and so the validation process is so complex and time-consuming and expensive that frankly it's just not worth it. Right? It takes forever and really limits what your customer can do with that product. So unless it's specifically geared for thank you, sir. Unless it's specifically geared for that, it's really not something you want to go for. Because the complexity, I mean, frankly, sometimes going from level 1 to level 2 isn't that big of a deal. It depends on the product, it depends on a lot of other things, but it's really not that much, objectively. When you get to level 3, all of a sudden, especially from a hardware perspective, the requirements just dramatically increase in complexity, right? To the point where, you know, I wonder why some people do it, because I don't think the value's there. So, you know, all that to say, you want to kind of pick, you know, your biggest bang for your buck here. But your most important one is that. What does your customer require, right? And that's at the end of the day, that's what matters. It doesn't matter what, you know, you think or what you feel is the best, you know, way or what the competition's doing or whatever. It really just matters what the customer wants. And like I said, frankly, most customers just need that FIPS thing. And they're moving on to the next item on, you know, do you have FIPS 140? Yes. Can you process a billion packets per second? Yes. Do you have two-factor authentication? Yes. Like so they're just going down this checklist. So, you know, very rarely will they spend a whole lot of time saying, well, we need you to meet FIPS 140-2 level 1, but we'd like level 3 for interfaces. You won't see that stuff. Yes, sir?
Question. Where you say perceived value, sorry if you covered this already, is the perception your own perception based on your industry experience, or would you say that's a shared perception?
I'd say it's perceived value both from my viewpoint, but also from the customer requirements and customer perception, right? So end user, you know, federal agencies. Good question.
In these product marketing measures, in these marketing, in the product ads and marketing advice for you also return the level from here?
Sometimes. You don't have to. Because frankly, sometimes people don't, some people just, oh, you have FIPS, okay, cool. So yeah. Sometimes it's not a big deal. If you want to, yeah, sure. Yeah, I don't think it hurts anything. If anything, it shows a little more acuity on your side. Yes, sir?
Do you have some ballpark numbers on the cost of validation for
different levels? Holy crap, 45 minutes. I didn't think that would take 45 minutes. I thought that was going to be one of the first questions. How long does it take? How much does it cost?
Well, sir, we are going to get there right now.
It takes too long. It costs too much. That's what you're going to hear all the time. And it costs a lot for a reason, but we're going to get there.
All right, so everything going okay so far? Okay. So Bill wanted to take a break at 10:15. It's 9:45. We're rocking and rolling. We're doing fine.
So now we're going to talk about process. We'll get to cost and all the stuff that you really care about. But in order to understand that, it's helpful to really understand the process, the players, what's involved, why it takes so long. That's what we're going to talk about now. So now's where you want to start paying attention. Okay, so earlier I said the basic process is document, test, validate, right? What we're going to do now is go through those in a little bit more detail. So when you're starting a generic FIPS 140, there's a bunch of different ways to get the FIPS 140 checkmark, but we're going to talk about just from a generic perspective right now, kind of a traditional route, if you will. The first step is actually contracting, right? Because, you know, a lot of folks, let's face it, some organizations are a bit difficult to deal with contractually. So, you know, one of the things that we always see is we'll get customers like, our sales cycle is either incredibly long or it's a matter of like a week, right? And it depends. Usually it's a vendor saying, well, we're planning for FIPS for this release. We need to plug in your module, you know, at this point. Or we'll get the, holy shit, I need FIPS 140. What can you guys do for me right now? I'm going to lose this deal, right? I mean, literally, that's what happens. And so the reason I put this contracting phase in is that sometimes that takes time, right? So a lot of folks won't plan for that. They won't have the budget allocated. They don't have the P&L set in terms of, is the business unit going to pay for it? Does it come out of a central fund? Like, you know, so you'll want to think about that as you're going through and planning your planning your FIPS strategy. And I put 1 to 2 months because, frankly, sometimes it can take that long. Not saying that's applicable to you, but we've seen that before, right? I mean, especially, not so much now, but more when I was doing consulting work. Sometimes we get a very large company that says, we need you right now. Okay, let's do it. Now we've got to get through all this paperwork first, right? And
so the 1 to 2 months is just for getting the paperwork done?
I'm sorry. Sometimes just for contracting. I mean, it can go really quickly. But I wanted to highlight this because any vendor, like if you're a product vendor that wants to go through FIPS 140, you need to have contracts in place with a testing laboratory or optionally a consultant or a software vendor or however you're going to do it. You need to have that vehicle in place before you can even continue the process.
So once you've got that piece settled,
the next phase, we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about this one, is documentation. Now, FIPS 140, like I said earlier, it's not a self-certification, right? It's not a vendor standing up saying, yep, I've read that standard, looks good, we need it. Some people do that, it won't get you very far. You need to actually document your products according to FIPS 140 requirements, right? And Mark is going to talk a lot about the documentation requirements, but there's some very specific documentation that has to be produced. And, you know, a lot of folks sometimes will come in with architectural diagrams on bar napkins and stuff like that, right? And say, well, you know, here's our product, here's how we do it. But that doesn't work. You have to have a very kind of formalized set of documentation. So the vendor usually produces this, or, you know, someone working on behalf of the vendor. And what they're documenting here is the crypto module, okay? So they're documenting how their product meets the FIPS 140 requirements. They're documenting what their product does. They're going through each of the different sections that we're going to talk about in a little bit and explaining very specifically how the product meets FIPS 140. Right? How does it do key management? How does it do authentication? How does it do access control? So it's very specific in terms of what this documentation is. And a general time to produce that documentation, assuming you know what you're doing, assuming you get it right, is about 1 to 2 months. So it takes a while to actually go through and bang out the documentation. And that's because there is a formula for the docs, but products are always so different. And there's different ways, like we were talking about a second ago with the hardware and the software. There's different ways to approach that documentation, right? So sometimes you can spend the first couple of weeks just figuring out, okay, how do I want to actually set this going forward? Because the way you do this documentation defines your whole testing process. So you want to get it right. Sometimes it just takes a little bit of time to do that.
Could you probably cover what are the
We will definitely go over crypto algorithms.
Modules, different subsystems that are using crypto
that
will be covered.
We will definitely go through that.
You betcha. So once you've got your documentation in order, you've written everything up, it's this beautiful pile that's this thick, you've got your product ready to go to testing, now what?
Well, now is when you send all of that documentation in your module to a testing laboratory, right? So there are 13 labs?
20.
13-ish.
There's 20 independent laboratories right now that will go through and test your product and evaluate your documentation, right? So the testing lab's job, this whole thing, and there's a bunch of them here, the testing lab's job is to make sure that the documentation meets all of the documentation requirements, right? They're gonna make sure that the product meets the functional requirements. And they're actually gonna go through and do some actual testing of the product. They're gonna do source code reviews. They're going to do algorithm testing. They're going to do a lot of different activities to make sure that, as you stated in the documentation, the product actually backs that up, right? So if in your documentation you say you generate keys this way, they're going to say, okay, let's look at the product. Show me it functionally, show me the key, show me the source code that generates the key. So the testing process can take a while. Now, some of this depends on levels, right? So fundamentally, a level 3 will take longer than a level 1 to go through this process. But this is kind of a huge variable here because I have 2 to 6 months plus written down. There's a slide coming up in a minute that talks about schedule dependencies, but you assume 2 months best case, right? That's usually assuming you've been through before, you've got a simple product that's stable, that's not going to change, you don't have to make any source code changes, you get through the first time. It takes about 2 months, right? It takes a while for the lab to go through all the documentation, it takes them a while to set up for the testing. It's not a quick thing. One of the things that I've seen in the past is that process can take forever, right? Especially for some organizations, if you go through and, if you've misdocumented something or your product actually doesn't meet one of the requirements that it should, or there's a source code change is required, sometimes that pushes out the development timeline, which also pushes out the testing timeline, which pushes out the validation process, right? Because you can't move on from this and so you've got everything checked off and ready to go. Make sense? Yes,
sir. I don't know if I missed it, but where is the product, when is the product developed, before or through?
Great question. So she asked, where is product development in this? Sadly, sometimes a lot of it's here. It depends on where you are in your development cycle and how you want to, how the timing works out. So one of the interesting things is that The FIPS validation is applicable to a specific like snapshot in time of a product, right? So it's, you know, super cool product version 3.1. That's what's validated. If you rev to 3.2, it's necessarily validated, right? So it's a very good question, right? How do you target your development life cycle to align with a validation cycle? And it's really freaking hard. It really is, because there's so many things you can do up here. And you can certainly get started early. You can say, well, let's do what we can to meet all the requirements. Let's get everything built in. And maybe you missed something here, or maybe the lab picks up something, or maybe a requirement changed. Or, you know, there's a lot of different gotchas that can kind of reset the clock. So you want to try to target it so that, you know, you're essentially code complete-ish around here. And if you have to make some changes for validation, you can. But frankly, it is very difficult to time. And sometimes, I feel like the best advice is to just get started, right? Because I've seen a lot of vendors that will try to time everything perfectly and just miss it every single time. Because it's such a development sometimes is such a variable in and of its own, right? When you try to overlay this validation process, which is extremely flexible, right? I mean, you know, there's a lot of different things that can impact the schedule here that sometimes they just don't align, right? So you might, and as I've sadly seen it before, where someone will miss a development window because they were trying to do everything the right way and it just didn't work out, right? So it's kind of one of those things where if you just start early and just, you know, do the best you can. Just go one of the things. Yes, sir.
On my phone that day about the week challenge.
Right.
So what are we most picking? what's due for it next week?
Well, you know what's funny? So that's actually how SafeLogic got started. So I was doing some consulting work, and we had a nice consulting team, and saw that challenge with mobile, exactly. Because, great, they rev all the time. So how do you maintain that? So what we did is basically developed a cryptographic module specifically for mobile. And our first customer was Symantec, because they had this mobility application, and they had the exact same problem. They were like, how do we do this? And I said, well, here's a way to do it. So one, you kind of got two different ways of structuring this. And we'll talk about this a little bit more, but it comes to down to how you define what's called a cryptographic boundary. And that is the set of software, the set of hardware that is included in the validation. So what we ended up doing with Symantec was narrowing down that cryptographic boundary to just the crypto piece, which happens to be us, but to just the crypto piece, right? So that way, they can change anything else they want upstream in the app. And as long as they don't touch the crypto, they can claim FIPS 140 validation, right? Their FIPS 140 validation certificate is still applicable, it's still valid, even though they can rev their app as much as they want. But then the challenge becomes, okay, do we test it on, you know, which phone do we test on? Because Apple releases its phone, you know. And so then you start playing that game of, you know, making sure everything's applicable to the hardware, which is actually a little bit of an easier problem than the software. But that's a really good question.
Yeah, I guess I also got a similar question, because we keep rolling out releases after releases to customers every few months.
Right.
So my question was, would every new release have to go through the FIPS validation again? That was, I guess, the same question.
So from a you know, maybe more enterprise software perspective, no, you don't have, once you validate once, you don't always have to validate in every single version. It's it may be as customer requirements mandate or something like that, right? So Mark's going to talk about uplifting validations and maintaining validations, because there is a way to specifically maintain them, where if you make changes, well, how does that work? What do I test? Mark will probably
decide. Does any change break the FIPS validation?
Yeah. If a change breaks the FIPS validation, then things get a lot more interesting in terms of retesting and whatnot. Yes, sir?
I understand that once you start the validation process, that there's a finite time. And then after that, you've got to start all over again. Is that right?
Yeah, they've put some throttles on testing and things like that, because what would happen is, one of the most valuable parts of this is getting into process here. So when you submitted your product and your documentation to a laboratory, you go on something called this in-process list, which basically is pretty much as good as gold in terms of a procurement standpoint, right? Because agencies can go through and purchase products that are in process. They don't have to be finished yet, but they're in process. So what folks are doing, we're just writing the list, right? They get in process, just sit there and just not finish. So they did start throttling that, right? I forgot what the time frame was.
Right. If they have some timelines, but you'll get dropped off of that list if you're not responding or making progress on the validation.
Yeah. If you're working towards completing it, you'll be fine. It's really just when folks would get there and just say, see ya, and go do other things, which happens, right? I mean, there's a million different priorities that you all have to deal with. So FIPS is just one of them. So sometimes people get busy. But yeah, they tried to curb that.
Right, didn't they just make a fairly recent change to the process in terms of breaking it into an implementation of a test list and whatever the file on it is? So.
Yeah, that's right. Actually go up to the web page and show those okay. lists and go over for everything.
Thanks.
Yeah, but they did do that.
Okay.
Right.
Yes, sir.
So you mentioned a few minutes ago about Symantec and just having a software launch over mm-hmm. encryption, and then you said, but what phone would it go on? Is it required that if I have can I get a piece of software validated without being on hardware?
No, it needs to be tested on something, and the platform on which it's tested needs to be documented. But there is a little bit of flexibility. So, for example, we don't have to test formally FIPS validate our module on every single iPhone that comes out, because there's something called a portability clause, which is where you can say, okay, we were tested on an iPhone 6S, ARM, whatever, right? It runs the same exact way on a 7. So we don't have to formally test on every single one, but any FIPS validation, even if it's software, has to be on a specified platform. And it could be anything. It could be a Dell server, it could be a HP server, it could be a MacBook. I mean, it can be anything, but it does have to be tested on something.
And then to be compliant, if somebody reads that, they have to use that server.
Not really. Not really. Because there are some ways. So like take Java, for example. Right, so Java you can run on any platform, right? You have to test it on a specific configuration, but as long as that implementation doesn't change between environments, you can run it on a different environment. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So we can't run our iOS module on an Android device. It just doesn't even make sense, right? So if as long as that or cryptographic module doesn't change between platforms, then you'd be okay. Now, when you start to look at something like Linux versus Windows versus Mac, well, then those are three separate things, right? And you can't always just say, well, we were tested on Windows, so we're good for every desktop OS.
And I'm just wondering how the customer, the federal customer, would know when they read the it says, well, it was tested on this, how would they know they could put it on something?
The answer is they may not know that. They may just see that you have the FIPS certificate and say, cool. But like we talked about earlier, they might see it on the list, and they might see that you've only been tested on Windows, and they might say, well, we're on Linux, so fix that. Right? So that's just going to depend on the end user. Yes?
Yeah, sort of along the same lines as that question. What if you want to run a FIPS module in a Docker or a containerized environment? You know it was coming.
We were just talking about this last week, actually. Containers get interesting. And actually, what I'm going to do, I'm going to wait on that one. And we'll have probably a bit more technical discussion on it. So a container still runs on some host OS, some platform somewhere, whether it's, we were talking about cloud-based stuff last night. Like, it gets pretty murky. And that's what I was saying earlier, right? The standard was written for smart cards, right? So it wasn't written for Docker containers and AWS and stuff like that, right? So it gets very complicated. But let's come back to that one, if you don't mind, because I want to go through some of the preliminaries, but that's a good question. Okay, so any questions on testing, right? In its purest form, pretty basic. It's a total pain, but pretty basic, right? Testing lab will go through, evaluate the documentation, test the product, and eventually spit out a test report. They'll say, here's everything that we looked at. We looked at the documentation, we looked at the product, here's how we did everything, and they submit that to the CMVP, which is the Cryptographic Module Validation Program. So these are the folks in NIST, the folks of the government, that will say, okay, testing lab, you say you've gone through and evaluated this product. Let's make sure you did what you're supposed to do, right? Did you test it thoroughly? And NIST will actually go through, CMVP will actually go through and review some documentation as well. Not quite as much as the lab will look at. They'll look at the lab's test report and something called a security policy, which Mark will talk about. But that's really all they look at in terms of documentation. But their job is to basically make sure the lab did their job, right? So it's kind of checking the checker, if you will. That process, so we say 3 to 5 months, that's pretty dynamic too. They've been banging stuff out pretty quickly lately. So, again, it's hard to plan, right? I've seen that queue go as long as 6 or 7 months, where literally you're just waiting in a queue for a NIST validator to go through and pick it up and say, okay, looks good, or return some comments or something like that. So going back to your question now about how do you align this with the development process, that's why it's so hard, because this, you have no idea, right? It could be any amount of time, and that's why you want to be careful saying, we're going to be validated in, first quarter 2018. William? Maybe, right? Some of it just depends on things that are outside of your control, and that's what makes it difficult from a timing perspective. But that's the basic process. So any questions on the process, on the timelines, all that stuff? Yes, sir.
As far as I understand, testing process, we test all the cryptomodule and its functionalities depending on its requirement from the TIPS 140. But what is the validation phase?
Sure. Great question. So the question is, what is the validation phase and why is it there? The validation phase is basically the folks at NIST that write the FIPS 140 standard, it's them making sure that the lab did a thorough job of testing. That they actually did their job with the testing, right? So they will go through, review documentation, review the lab's test report, and they'll say, yes, testing lab, you did everything as you should. And they actually issue the validation certificate. So they're the ones at the end of the day that give the actual validation certificate. So we just call that the validation phase, where it's making sure that everything comes together and everything was done properly.
Why do you separate the two things and testing them?
So we separate them because they're different entities that do each, right? So we can't have a testing lab say, yep, we did it and we did a great job, we're going to issue a certificate, right? It's kind of a conflict of interest. So they have to be checked by the government, by NIST. So it's two different phases just because it is two separate steps of the process. So once you finish testing, at that point you're waiting on the actual certificate. So finishing testing is a huge milestone, but it doesn't mean that you're done.
And you mean that after testing, the government agency also reevaluate all the testing report and security policies in their work?
No.
Why did they delegate their process to the testing lab?
Because that would be because they need to make sure that the lab did a thorough job. Even though they audit labs every other year, they need to make sure that the lab did the job that the lab is supposed to do. So they're actually, like I said, just checking the lab to make sure all of that went through properly. I mean, yes, it sometimes seems like an unnecessary step. And I argue that a while back. I was like, hey, yes, trust your labs, right? But it doesn't always work that way.
Yeah, I'll add a little flavor to that. The CNBP doesn't have the resources to do all of the testing and the validation. So they actually accredit the 20 FIPS labs that exist worldwide, and they trust them to do all of the testing. But then, as Ray mentioned, they check at the end to verify that all of those testing steps were completed successfully. And during that test and validate process, it may go back and forth to resolve any open questions that the CNBP or regulators have on that report. So that's how they are able to do nearly 300 FIPS modules a year, by using those labs to perform all of those steps, and they do the validation process.
Yes, sir.
So if you release a new version of the same product, do you still have to go through the same process?
A new version of the same product, do you have to go through the same process? Yes, although it might be compressed. So the timelines would be compressed, the activities would be compressed. Mark's going to talk about that one. Okay, so that's the process. So as we're going through a little bit later and talking about the documentation, what I want you to think about is this phase, right? So when Mark's talking about vendor evidence docs and finance state models and security policies, think about this. When he's talking about technical requirements and laboratory management, all that stuff, think about right here, okay? This is where you're gonna have most of your activity. Like I said, here, there's really not much going on from your side.
So you're kind of just waiting.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
So, where does the security policy come from? Is it coming from the documentation step? Because the documentation step seems to be sort of a problem. So, because it the last one.
So, the security policy is one document that's produced in this phase. So it's basically it's a non-proprietary document that summarizes how the product meets FIPS 140, and it's actually posted with the IP certificate. So it's a very valuable document because although it's written here, it's evaluated by the lab, but also validated by NIST as well. So it's definitely an important document, but it's first creation happens right here.
So what is the actual end result? So at the end of the day, after you go through all the process, do you get a piece of paper that says you are FIPS 140 certified?
No, you don't get a piece of paper anymore. You get a listing on site.
Certified.
You used to get a hard copy thing signed by a bunch of people and frame it, put it in your office.
Right.
No, now you just get a listing on a website.
Listing on a website. That's
but
it.
It's a very valuable listing. So they used to do that, right? So they would actually print up really nice certificates, have them signed by all the validators, and have a big party and all that stuff. So now they started just doing electronically, would just put a PDF up on the site. Well, now they, like Mark was saying, they have group certificates now where and they do that to save time, right? Because that validation process was taking so long. I mean, if you're a vendor and you're waiting for your certificate, frankly, you don't need a week for it to go up to Canada to get signed and then come back. Like, there's just one more step that takes a while. So at the end of the day, you're listed on the validated product list, which we'll pull out momentarily so you can see what that looks like.
But is there a difference between the FIPS 140 validation and CMVP certification?
No.
Or are they the one and the same?
Yeah, for all intents and purposes, they're the same. Because the CMVP, the Cryptographic Model Validation Program, runs FIPS 140, and they're the ones that, so when you go to the CMVP website, it's FIPS 140 validated products.
Got it.
Okay, so We're doing pretty well on time, actually. schedule dependencies. We're going to go over this, and then we're going to go on a break. And then we're going to keep chugging through. So the question about development timelines that was asked earlier, and the whole flexibility on that timeline slide that I showed earlier, right, where it says like 2 to 5 months, 3 to 5 months, 6 months, you know, all that stuff. What drives those ranges? Well, a FIPS 140 schedule has a whole lot of dependencies, right? The first one is your code ready? Is your product actually ready for FIPS 140? As you'll see later, probably not, right? There's a lot of interesting requirements in there that, frankly, product vendors just don't build into the product, right? assuming you're doing everything yourself. We're a product vendor. We build it in because we have to. But if you're just, you know, if you're taking a product through a traditional FIPS validation process, chances are you're going to have to make some changes somewhere down the line, right? And that's a huge dependency. And basically, how quickly you can react to a code change, how quickly you can make it happen, and making sure it's correct, can compress that overall schedule. How good are the documentation, right? Like I was saying earlier, sometimes people will come in with the architectural diagram on the bar napkin and say, here's how we do key management. And that's really not how you document key management, right? So a lab will have to look at that and they'll say, well, okay, I think I see what you're saying here. So they'll have to facilitate this whole discussion. Okay, how are you actually doing your keys? And then so that they can more effectively write their report. So what you want to do with your documentation, you want that stuff to be so polished that the lab can look at it and say, awesome, this is what I need to finish my test report. And then you make it stupid easy for them to get through the process, right? And that really compresses down the time frame. Algorithm testing. This is always a big one. So we're going to talk about this later, but one of the aspects to a FIPS validation is not just saying we have ABS, for example. It's proving that your ABS implementation is correct. And that's not as easy as you would think, right? So sometimes, and that's frankly, as an aside, that's one of the values of the FIPS 140 program, because sometimes we've heard folks out there saying, oh yeah, FIPS, we're good, we have ABS. Okay, not the same at all, right? And maybe they don't understand it because this stuff is kind of confusing, but I think they do, I think they're just, you know. But just having ABS doesn't mean anything, right? And so you want to make sure your ABS implementation is correct, not only from a security perspective, but also think about it from an interoperability perspective, right? So I'll give you an example from Cisco days. So we were doing ICSA validation for IPsec. And part of that is IPsec interoperability. So they wanted to make sure that a Cisco box could talk to a NetStream. Well, come to find out, there were some issues with interoperability, and it turns out there was a flaw with the ABS algorithm because it wasn't implemented correctly, right? So one side's encrypting it, the other side's trying to decrypt it, and it's not coming up with the correct result because this implementation was wrong. So one of the values here is actually testing the algorithm to make sure that it is implemented properly. And like I said, it's not an easy, you know, data in, data out check. It's pretty invasive.
That's assuming that they are implementing or using the other
right.
I mean, but are there libraries for, you know, standard algorithms?
Certainly. And there's a bunch out there. I mean, we've got an AES implementation that's been through before, right? So sometimes people will leverage that, or they may write their own AES implementation and get that tested. They may leverage it from hardware. Like, there's a lot of different ways to get there. It's just that if you don't have that validation certificate, or I'm sorry, that algorithm testing for your specific algorithm implementation, you'll need it.
I was under the impression that there are like FIPS-approved libraries that you know, products can just call the
functions. Yeah, they're definitely. I mean, we're one of them. So yeah. So that's definitely an option, right? So sometimes instead of going through all this stuff, someone will say, well, let me just plug in, say Flogic, for example,
and that has all the subtests, that has all the algorithm testing done. It's got, you know, all the FIPS things checked off already. So that is an option.
But if we did that, then it would suggest that the device that is using the safe logic module is using the safe FIPS compliant safe logic module. That does not mean the device itself is FIPS compliant. Here, the objective is to make sure the device is cooking.
Absolutely. So, and that comes down to defining the cryptographic boundary, right? And how you specifically state that you meet the requirements, right? So what you would say is, my appliance uses FIPS validated cryptography, right? As opposed to saying my appliance is validated, because an appliance validation is a completely different animal. But again, that's going to come down to customer requirement, right? Customer requirement may not be for the whole appliance. They might just need that one little piece. So just all depends. Another schedule dependency. Do you actually have time to go through and support this stuff, right? So saw this a lot during both Cisco and consulting, right? Where people want to get started, they've got you know, requirements, they've got, you know, salespeople doing, you know, kind of barking orders and trying to get stuff done. And you get started and something else comes up. And then something else comes up. Okay, we'll get to FIPS in a minute. We've got another customer issue with, you know, XYZ. Okay, we'll get to that in a second. Now we're working on a new release. Okay, we'll come back to FIPS because we've got this other thing. And all of a sudden, FIPS gets farther and farther and farther and farther and farther away. Right? And getting back on track for a FIPS 140 project can actually take a while. Right? Someone leaves. Someone gets reassigned. Like, there's a lot of different things that can affect that schedule. So if you're going through the process, and, you know, I'd recommend having, you know, a dedicated, you know, product manager or program manager that's really going to take ownership of it and make sure that it gets done. Knowing how to manage it, again, that's kind of another thing. There's a lot of different moving pieces to it, and it's kind of tied into the first one, right? I mean, do you have time for it, and can you actually make sure that it happens? Then the last one, do you need that level 4? Chances are you probably don't. And, you know, sometimes I hate to see someone miss the market or miss an opportunity because they're trying to do too much, right? And that happens, right? Someone will say, well, level 1 sounds good, but level 3 sounds a whole lot better. So I'm going to do that, and it's going to take me 3 times as long, but damn it, it's going to be worth it. And frankly, it isn't. And that just increases the risk of everything else going haywire because, you know, things are going to start to fall off. You're going to have new products and new features to pay attention to. People might move on. So it just makes things a little bit more risky if you go through and attain a level that you really don't have to. So
what kind of markets are there for level 3?
They've fallen off a little bit. So the question was, what kind of markets are for level 3 and level 4? They've fallen off quite a bit. So, like I say, back in 2002 or 3, the Department of Defense, specifically the Army, had this directive where they were requiring, at a minimum, level 2 for anything, but certain things at level 3. So, you know, all the wireless products at Cisco had to go through level 3 because that's what it doesn't add that much security. I don't know why they were saying that. But we've seen those requirements kind of fall off a bit, only because it limits the products that are available, right? Because there's not any level 3 validations. Mark's got a slide later that talks about, you know, how many products are going to go with level 1 versus level 2 and level 3. And you'll see, like, there's almost that same curve where when you start to get to level 3, it drops down. Then it gets to level 4. There's only a couple, and most of the time, you know, we put a validated chip, and then they put the chip on a board, and then another chip, right? So, the requirements aren't there, usually. And again, it's because it kind of hamstrings what the federal government can do in terms of, you know, product acquisition. Because they're trying to, you know, the government's on the way, they're trying to be a little bit more aggressive in terms of how they, you know, procure products and deploy products, and they want to use technology later than Windows 95. So, you know, they're trying to trend some of this stuff down where they can. But their challenge is they still have to have you know, assurance requirements because they've got their own system security policies to meet. So we see that level requirement for, well, the requirement for increased novels falling off a bit, but it's still there for FIPS 140 in general.
Yeah, I would say level 3 modules are usually single chip modules. Smart cards are often validated at level 3. There's several HSMs that are validated at level 3. A lot of USB sticks that have hard epoxy coating can be evaluated at level 3. So those are mostly the level 3 ones. And then there's just a small handful of HSMs usually at level 4. And I know that you're trying to hit it.
Oh, we blew that. No, I'm just kidding. We're actually not doing too bad.
First of all, I love all the questions. They're awesome. Usually when we do stuff like this, it's kind of like glazed over eyes. And that's kind of what we talk about sometimes. It's like, I love having people drive the discussion because there are so many freaking questions when you're going into this stuff. And we want to hear every single one. So personally, I love it. Like, I love all the interaction. I love when you ask questions real time and stuff like that. Because, like I said, we want to make sure that you get something out of this, right? You're spending 3 hours with us, it might as well be worthwhile, right? So, all right, so anyway, so with that, let's take a little bit of a break. How long does everybody want? Like 5 minutes, 10 minutes? How long does everybody need?
Let's do 10:40.
10:40?
I heard that, 10:40.
15 minutes?
Yeah.
15 minutes? All right, 15 minutes. Be back. Thanks, everybody.
I'm going to go to the next one.
might have one of the things running around the block.
So since you use ISO
one way of selecting the lab is seeing what type of products.
they have their chances. We'll see if they have experience in your technology. Yeah, for our survey.
All right, who's ready to rock and roll? You good? Good break. Excellent. Okay. So first of all, thank you all for coming back.
didn't chase you off in the first place, so that's a good thing. No, seriously, thanks for coming back. I hope it's been a good session.
So, so a couple things. So one, I meant to tell you at the very beginning, a long time ago, one of my co-founders and I wrote this book called FIPS 140 Demystified, which is basically just a book about all things FIPS 140. And we wrote it about 6 years ago, so we didn't really maintain it. But there's still a lot of good information in there. It's actually kind of interesting. A lot of the problems that we talked about kind of solved with the safe logic side of things. But there's still a good amount of information about, you know, process and issues and best practices and all that stuff. So we've got a couple of copies that we're going to give out somehow or another throughout the day. So there's that. Also, after our session, there's a session with Tammy Green and Carolyn French and I think Ashid, right? Going over all things, you know, kind of more of a deep dive into validation, best practices, and case studies and things like that. And they're all awesome people. Like they really know their stuff. They're entertaining. They're just very sharp people. So just based on some of the questions that we've heard and some of the content that it seems like you all are interested in, definitely check that one out because I think it'll be pretty cool. They're going to go over all sorts of just interesting things. So definitely check that one out. Okay, so with that, I'm going to leave you with the very capable and very handsome Mark Bennett.
Thanks, Rick.
I should have given you the whole, like, basketball intro. Like,
he's a 6'5" account manager from San Luis Obispo.
We'll do that next time.
I'm just needing now the sweatpants to take those off. All right.
You do need sweatpants.
Awesome.
Love the questions. I'm going to go a little bit deeper. I'm not going to get super deep, but definitely going to answer some of those questions that we had in a little bit more detail as we go through the documentation requirements. I have some prime questions, but now I've seen the audience, and I don't think we need to prime any questions, but just in case, I have questions that you need to know and need to ask. So let's go, documentation. So Ray talked about the importance of the FIPS 140-2 security policy. It is a required document. On the NIST website, there is a link that gets posted to it, so customers or prospective customers can actually click on that link and see the security policy that has gone through the FIPS validation process. So that's extremely important. The vendor evidence, I like to think of this as some of the secret sauce that you may not want to share with your customers, but it's an important information to help your laboratory get through the FIPS validation process. The more helpful information you can accumulate and consolidate into this vendor evidence document makes it much easier for your lab to create that report. There's a few labs in here. I'm guessing about 70% of the assessments that the laboratory needs to write responses to in the report come from documentation-related evidence. And so the security policy and vendor evidence that. I like to throw in configuration management information into the vendor evidence document because you don't want to throw that in your security policy. Your customers probably don't care too much about how you virtually control everything, but that is one of the examples of requirements that you need to say what system you use for configuration management. How, any time that we've had these questions, what happens if I change my module? Well, if you change your module, you make a change to the source code or hardware component inside of your cryptographic boundary, then you need to have a version change. So you need to describe how you track those different versions in your product. Finite state model, as Ray mentioned, the requirements were originally developed for hardware cryptographic models in mind. They're very hardware-focused. They thought that these encryption engines were just going to do these metallic boxes with a wire in and a wire out, and that was how all FIPS models were going to be. Finite state model comes from that, which is a diagram that shows that you have these defined states. There's never a period where your model is operating where it's in an unknown state. It has to be in these specific states. There are some required states, and one of the things that you need to do in the validation process is have a finite state model. It's a required document. Section 4.4 in the FIPS guidance talks all about that. But you can spend as much time as you want on these or make it very, very simple. I recommend simple that meets the requirements. Those are just some examples of the documentation. You do this early in the process so you can set your lab up for success. What they want to see is that the documentation matches the source code that they're going to look at, which matches the functionality of your cryptographic model. If all of those are in sync, then you're going to go through that validation process much easier.
Excuse me, can I just ask a quick question?
Yeah.
The source code, so for example, if you're building some embedded system and you're looking at generic block bindings and sort of kernel, I mean, are they checking all of that source code as well?
It's not an exhaustive source code review as part of the FIPS validation process. There's not much value in a laboratory starting at line one and trying to get through all of that. What they're going to focus on are the requirements for FIPS, which are the self-tests. They're going to make sure that all the self-tests are implemented, that if you go into an error condition because the self-test fails, for example, that you have a proper error state. So they'll look at your finite state model and make sure that they can flow through all of those states and that it is consistent with the source code. So they're looking for those consistencies between the source code and the finite state model. But no, it's not an exhaustive list. You're going to really focus on it. So some supporting documentation that's required for the laboratory to successfully complete their report is a key management document or information that gives you the whole life cycle of the keys that are touched by your cryptographic model. So this includes the generation, the use, the destruction, the input, output. All of those details are essential for them to complete their FIPS report successfully. My least favorite requirement in the FIPS 140-2 requirements is the FCC certificate for EMI, EMC. So this is just making sure that if you develop the hardware cryptographic model, that it's safe for use in business environments or at higher levels for safer use in home environments. Or if you're a software module that you run on the generally available personal view of some sort of appliance that can do this requirements. Almost positive that's going to be away in the next release at some point. There's also a master list of components. You have a bill of materials list that shows all of the hardware components that make up your cryptographic module. Also, all of the firmware or software components. All of that needs to be tracked, version controlled. Things that you're doing today, just basic development, good practices. But we need to make sure that that's documented and those lists are available. The laboratory is going to look and say, okay, you say you're using this processor? Yes, indeed, you're using this processor. You're saying you're using this memory? Yes, indeed, you're using that memory. So they'll do a sanity check there. On block diagrams, the block diagram generally goes into your security policy, just a high-level architecture view of the interfaces of your device. You can look at existing security policies to get samples and ideas. And I also mentioned that the source code list, you can see that your version control, if you indeed change a file in your source library, that it does cause new version to be incremented. which can be a challenge too, because a lot of customers are using off-the-shelf hardware. Yeah. You work with your lab on that. There may be, you know, schematics are much more important for like an integrated circuit that's custom designed. That want to see that. Or if you're doing level 3, level 4 testing, those sort of things, they'll really make sure that no plain text secrets are available, especially for level 3 and level 4. So Ray talked about how these FIPS validations, you get posted finally on the NIST website, you have a certificate number, there's a hardware part number listed, and a software or firmware version number listed, and that is a snapshot point in time. Well, your products don't stay stagnant for years, months, weeks, perhaps some time, but it is important that you have some sort of a strategy to maintain a FIPS certificate. You put a lot of investment, time, effort, and money into getting that FIPS certificate. So how do you continue to maintain that FIPS certificate over time? Because if you change something inside of your cryptographic module, there's kind of like three really big types of maintenance activities. The first one is the simplest. You can call, a lot of people call them a bug fix or maintenance type fix. And this is a non-security relevant change to your crypto module. So that means that maybe you're changing look and feel or adding, making some corrections that are not security relevant at all from a FIPS standpoint, but it's important to your customer. So that is something where you contract with your laboratory or your consultant and say, hey, here's the fix I've made, here's why it's non-security relevant, can I do an update? Those happen very quickly. Oftentimes they don't involve any additional testing. It's usually a quick source code review to verify that the changes are indeed as you described. And then you can write a letter to the laboratory or to the CMVP. CMVP will review it and say, yep, we're going to add version 2.1 to your FIPS certificate. So now you have version 2.0. And this bug fix or maintenance update to include 2.1, your customers can go look and say, yes, version 2.1 is also on the NIST website and still using FIPS validated crypto module. That's the easy one. The other one is a security relevant change, and there are kind of two flavors of that. There's the flavor of you've made less than 30% changes to security-relevant functionality of your crypto module. Maybe you've added some new services. Maybe you've added a new algorithm or two, something like that. And you drop below that 30% threshold. If that's hard to estimate for you, your lab is really good at figuring that out. So if you are in that revalidation area there, you do have to do regression testing, which includes a lot of the FIPS testing. There's documentation review, there's oftentimes algorithm testing that gets pulled into that, and then operational testing, and your lab will work with you on that. And finally, they'll submit a revalidation report to the CMVP, and they'll review it. And generally that process is a lot quicker than the full validation. The last effort is, wow, you've made a lot of changes. It's clearly more than 30% of the security relevant changes that you have in this new version of the product, or maybe you changed the physical enclosure or something like that. That's going to go back through the whole revalidation process. But hey, you've already been through that process once, so you're really good at it now. Your laboratory understands your product and technology, so you know, hopefully that'll go faster, because you've already had a look at the documentation. You're just really updating and maintaining that documentation. So those are the three main types of maintaining those.
They get categorized like cell phone, cell two, or something. Is that what we're talking about here?
That's correct. The terminology, there's a document, if you don't have time to pull up the CMVP website, go to some of the documents that the CNPP has published. One of those is the FIPS 140-2 implementation guidance, and it talks directly about how to maintain a cryptographic module. And the terminology they use there are one sub, three sub, five sub. So one sub is that quick maintenance update of non-security relevant. Three sub is that revalidation effort, less than 30% crypto changes. And then a five sub is a full validation.
I think the IEC, I had gone to the IEC, but it also talks about the different types of tests and what each of the formats in the test contains. Is that the IEC?
Different types of tests. Oh, regression testing.
Yes, test
happen.
Test.
Yeah, that's helpful for the laboratory to know which parts of the retesting, regression testing needs to happen.
No, but we would also want to know the different formats of the tests because we would want to know what are these inputs standing for, what are these outputs standing for. Okay. So when we work on the code, we can force those tests and we can see whether they are actually working correctly.
Okay, are you talking about the algorithm tests?
Yes,
okay.
Algorithm tests. Is there a part of the implementation
guidance? It's maybe not in the implementation guidance, but part of the FIPS testing process, Ray touched on this, is that you have to verify that you've implemented those algorithms properly. And the way you do this, it's like a take-home test. You tell your FIPS laboratory, here are all the algorithms, all the modes, all the key sizes that my cryptographic module uses. And they'll take that information, generate test vectors for you. You take those test vectors, run them through your implementation on your hardware, your operating system, and it produces these results, results files, which you send back to the laboratory and go, okay, here's my take-home test responses. Go ahead and check these out. And they have a tool that's provided by the CNPP, and that's specifically the CAVP, the Cryptographic Algorithm Validation Program within the CNPP. And they will use that tool to verify that the algorithms are indeed implemented properly. And interesting, but algorithms actually receive their own certificate. So it's posted also on the NIST website. So you'll get a certificate for AES, for RSA, for ECDSA, so you'll get individual little algorithm certificates which go into that security policy. So that's one of the prerequisites in the whole testing process. And that can be easy or tricky if you're algorithm testing something labs are going to help you come along through that process.
There was some questions earlier on the portability of a module. Does that portability also apply to the algorithm that's being tested on a platform, and so on and so forth?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because SafeLogic, we're in the software module crypto business, we like to help our customers heavily leverage the porting guidance that's provided by the CNPP, which says if you've tested on a specific hardware platform and a specific operating environment, that'll get listed on your CNPP NIST certificate when you get your FIPS certificate. But what happens when that new version comes out or if it's a slightly different hardware platform? Well, you as a vendor can say, well, we also work on this new version of the operating system in this other hardware platform, and you can include that as what's called vendor affirmed in your security policy, which means it's in a section that says, hey, this wasn't tested as part of the FIPS process, but we verify that it works, and therefore you can maintain the validity of your FIPS certificate on this new platform, this new operating system, new hardware. And that's fine. Federal agencies can say, great, that's super, we can still acquire this certificate is still valid. The other option is to be, if you're a belt and suspenders type of person, you can do the FIPS testing for that. So you can actually work with your consultant vendor or your FIPS lab and do the specific testing. Let's say you tested Windows 2008, you want to test on Windows 2012. People can help you do that. And then that 2012 gets updated on the NIST website. That's also being submitted as a one sub effort to the CMDB so they can quickly add that new operating system and configuration to your web search.
I think I covered all these.
Just related to that, but the hardware is slightly different, isn't it? So if you've got a version of hardware and then modify, make an upgrade, then you basically have to go through the whole process.
Yeah, there are some techniques to that. Like I just was working with a customer that's doing a hardware-based validation, and they say, we can build this product with this bill of materials list, meaning we can select memory from this vendor or from this vendor, and that's all covered in their configuration management. So it's possible that they can use different vendors to build their FIPS module. So same part number version and everything like that. So that gives them that flexibility of, you know, they get a better price on memory from vendor A rather than vendor B, they can move that direction. So it helps them. They don't have to maintain their certificate of doing that. But if they were to change the processor or make enclosure changes, that would, you know, change the part number, the version number. Then all of a sudden, version 2.0 is on the NIST website, but version 2.1 is not. So your federal customers have the option. They can buy and use, they're only supposed to buy and use version 2.0, but your sales guys aren't going to stop them from buying 2.1. You know, that's on them. If they assume that risk of using a model that's not established at that point. Oftentimes, and Ray can speak to this because he came from the vendor side of things. And I came from a laboratory. I started in FIPS back in 2007, became laboratory director, and then joined SafeLogic a bit ago. And I would see technology vendors that would have a regular schedule. So maybe every 6 months or once a year, they would do some sort of maintenance activity, either a bug fix, maintenance update, or they would go through a whole revalidation. So that's typically what they do. They'd say version 2.0 is FIPS validated, 2.1 no, 2.2 no, 2.5 yes, we're going to FIPS validate that. So that would allow customers to jump to those point releases that are listed on the NIST website.
We talked about the implementation guidance. This is very important. The FIPS 140-2 implementation guidance is what the document is called. And that does get updated frequently. The CMDP has no power and ability to update the FIPS 140-2 requirements themselves until they go through an entire new release. But they can provide clarifying information and guidance, and they often update this and publish it as laboratories will run into a situation, a new technology, and say, hey, what about this sort of situation? We haven't run into this before. What do you think about this? And laboratories are now helping draft this guidance, and it's really become an important document. There are certain things that you don't want to go and do something you don't need to do. Like you don't want to zeroize your startup integrity key when there's no requirement to do that, because it will say that in the implementation guidance. Or you don't want to zeroize any of your self-test keys, because as long as you're not using those for any real purpose, then there's no need to do that. So in implementation guidance, very important, pay attention to it. Your FIPS lab will always have the latest and greatest on this, so it's always good to stay in contact with them or your consultant to make sure that you don't get extra points for having more self-tests than you need. So why not reduce that startup time and use the minimum amount of self-tests? That's what I always say. And my favorite is that porting that in some IG, because you
you want to leverage that. It's there for a reason. You want to make sure that you're keeping your customers safe from audits and that you're providing them good guidance on how to port that FIPS certificate to other operating environments. So basically,
this is
there's another document which is called the Derived Test Requirements, and that's FIPS 140-2 Derived Test Requirements, are affectionately known as the DTR, and that has assertions, you know, what's required of the vendor and then what's required of the FIPS tester. So there's the ASs, the VEs, and the TEs, and they're all numbered and they're associated with the sections back in the FIPS 140-2 requirements. And this is one that comes out of the physical security section, section 5, and it says the enclosure of the encrypted module shall be opaque within the visible spectrum. And this is at levels 2, 3, and 4, which means that an observer can't take your cryptographic module and be able to see in and view sensitive components like processors and memory and have, you know, easy visible access to that at levels 2 and above. And the vendor evidence that you have to supply is, hey, you have to show that your documentation, maybe this is some of your hardware diagrams and actual maybe pictures that show, well, there are events, but they're blocks and you can't see into any of those sensitive.
And then the implementation guidance says, well, what is opacity?
You know, what does that mean? I won't make you look at this, but it's just visual inspection. You want to make sure that you don't give an observer easy access to traces or components that could lead to a compromise in security of the module without detection.
Yeah, and so just as a bit of a side, this was one at Cisco that always gave us a hell of a time, right? So part of the reason they came up with the implementation guidance was because we had no freaking idea how to, what would constitute opaque for a chassis, right? Especially if you have a big switch with these, you know, massive vent holes, right? So the implementation guidance basically kind of, like Mark was saying, adds a little bit of substance to that opacity requirement, but it tried to make it a little bit more, you know, here's what we mean by opaque. You know, it has to be opaque within the visible spectrum. I don't know the visible spectrum. I don't know what the hell else we'd be talking about. But then the implementation guidance, when they say, okay, like Mark said, we shouldn't see any, you know, traces or architectural components or anything like that, it's still a little bit subjective. Like where a lab will go through and I think I can see something. And so this is one that comes in at level 2, but it's one of the reasons level 2 is so challenging, because a vendor will go through and try to design an appliance for level 2 and try to meet this opacity requirement and get almost subjectively kicked back. It's like, what's going on? I don't even understand it. So it's always an interesting example to throw up there to just say how sometimes confusing this process can be and how it's not always purely black and white.
So is this the reason why hardware security modules, I've seen some that are completely blackish in color and you cannot see anything inside, you know, if you try to remove it, the keys are all in long diet. Is this the reason? Opacity?
Exactly. The device is trying to meet level 3 requirements, especially a lot of HSMs are. You can't see in, and if you remove the cover, you either want the module to be destroyed or for there to be circuitry to serialize and see if it's there. Those are part of the physical security requirements. And certainly you want to prevent an observer from being able to see or touch sensitive components.
Thank you.
There are 11 sections in the FIPS 140-2 requirements, and these are a quick look at all of those different sections. Ray had mentioned before that every FIPS cryptographic model gets an overall level, so it's the whatever the lowest number is for any of these levels, that is the overall level of the cryptographic model. But you can get higher security levels for certain sections. And the example that Ray gave was authentication. If you're doing identity-based authentication because you're using public-private key pairs to authenticate to a module, then yeah, that's something to brag about. So let's get level 3 for role services and authentication if you meet all the requirements. And that's something your FIPS lab, your consultant can definitely help you out with to bump up those levels. I just got back from testing a product where my customer has an appliance. They're doing an overall level 2, oddly, because they can't meet level 3 requirements for EMI and EMC, and this thing's going to go in a data center. They don't care about it meeting home use of EMC requirements. But every other section that they can achieve level 3, they want to do that. So they're using identity-based authentication. They're going to do that. For design assurance, this is talking about your configuration management system, how you're using a high-level language. They were using a high-level language, so they're going to opt for level 3 in design assurance. So there's a table in the FIPS 140-2 publication itself, table 2, it's been a long time since I took my FIPS proficiency test, so I can't remember specifics, but I remember there was at the lab that I went through, there was a test for all the engineers to make sure they had a good level of understanding of the requirements. And the CMEP actually does the accreditations for all of the FIPS labs, and they come every 2 years to visit your laboratory and give you one of those high-pressure roundtable discussions on the right. Yeah, they'll talk to you and make sure you know all the requirements. So that's always fun. So some of the levels where some of the areas where you can get higher levels, like even if you have an overall level 1, you can get higher levels in cryptographic model specification. This talks about your cryptographic boundary and how it knows it's in the FIPS approved mode of operation. So if it's self-aware and it can show an indicator that it is in the FIPS approved mode of operation, you can achieve higher levels in there. Model interfaces, role services. So some of these will just, like finite state machine or finite state model will adopt the whatever the overall level of the model is. Certain physical security, there's differences at all four levels.
So first one, I'm going to kind of rapid fire through these because this is all well documented in the FIPS 140-2 publication. But here's where you define your cryptographic boundary. This is no small task. I've gone on site visits for customers, and it's taking us 2-3 days sometimes to define that cryptographic boundary. So you cannot underestimate that this could be more difficult than you anticipate. And you have to make sure that FIPS cares, it's very centric to the cryptographic module. It cares about what that boundary is and the inputs and outputs to that boundary. So that's where you need to meet those requirements. To know what's in, what's out.
I have a question now. What happens if there are other components which are also used in crypto in addition to this module, this boundary? Mm-hmm. Now, those are outside the boundary, but they are using crypto, and the crypto needs to be covered by FIPS. So, will that module also end up getting included in the crypto boundary because of this? So, it doesn't keep changing?
Good question. The question was if you, let's say you have a product or a device, and it has cryptographic library here that you want to validate, but there's other cryptographic components all part of that. depends on what your boundary is. If your boundary is only this cryptographic library, then that's what you need to meet, where you need to meet the requirements. If you want to show your customers that this entire appliance is FIPS validated, then you need to make some decisions. In fact, I did this with my customer just last week, because they care deeply about this crypto library, but they're validating the whole box. There's some other crypto going on in there, but they're not using it, and they don't need it for the protection of sensitive but unclassified information. So they're just treating that as same as plain text. They're not concerned about it at all. They just want to focus on that one crypto library. So that's how they're meeting those requirements, increasing the boundary. But if you had a hardware device that was part of your boundary and it was important for doing crypto, and software, then you may want to validate everything. So you would have to meet the requirements for all of those different crypto implementations.
Because I'm doing something similar right now. I'm doing similar work in my current place. So you have the crypto module that is being boundary. You have these other modules which are using other cryptos. But now, instead of considering them as part of this box, why don't we reroute those to use this, make calls to this module that sets the boundary and return. And now this is already covered, so that gets taken care of this way.
Yeah, so the question there was, if you're using two crypto implementations, wouldn't it be wise to just do a single one, just centralize all of your crypto?
Change those
calls. Right, change the calls. Certainly, yeah, that's a design consideration that you may do. There may be some challenges there depending on your implementation. You may have kernel crypto that's going on and then user space crypto, and you may want to validate both of those. So that could be a reason why you would have to validate both. So you could validate those modules separately and say, hey, your product has two embedded crypto modules in it, or you could validate at the entire box level and say, hey, this whole box is FIPS validated. You have to think about the maintenance activity too, because if you change any components inside that device, then your whole product has to go through the FIPS process. You have to maintain that. Whereas if you have those nice embedded crypto modules, you can make changes to your product. It's not touching the crypto boundaries at all, so those certificates can still exist without maintaining them.
I think in the next section, I think for some of the case studies, I might be going through some of those hybrid modules, if you want to call them that.
So is that finding the crypto boundary mutually based on the customer request, or more from me, the vendor, I think, or the engineering understanding of where the data flows and whatnot?
It's certainly, ultimately, it's the customer's decision on how to define that crypto boundary. But your laboratory, your consultant can provide a lot of guidance there and give you options. So, all right, here's a strategy with a larger crypto boundary. You know, here's the pluses and minuses. Here's a strategy for defining smaller crypto boundary, more boundaries, and giving multiple validations. So there's always that strategy, you know, what's good for the company, what makes sense for maintainability.
So you negotiate that with the vendor and you get certified and now you're listed on the website. Does that change what boundary you have?
Yes, the boundary definition is part of the security policy, so that'll be clear. Usually it's with a picture or a block diagram. So a software module would be a block diagram and you draw a little box around your cryptographic boundary.
And then it's up to the customer to say whether that satisfies their requirements.
Sure. Correct. That's the customer reviews the security policy to verify that the security rules that are described in the security policy will meet their requirements for acquiring the product. So this cryptographic module specification, as I mentioned, at levels 3 and 4, you have to indicate that you're in that FIPS approved mode of operation, and the module needs to be self-aware of that. And it's
It sounds like a little thing. It can be complicated for some cryptographic modules, but that's something where your FIPS lab or consulting can definitely help you, if you meet those requirements, take advantage of that. The next section, 4.2 in the FIPS pub, is the module interfaces. These are the physical in and out ports. So whatever you've defined your cryptographic boundary, let's say it's a hardware appliance, then you're talking about your Ethernet ports, your serial ports, your power input, you know, anything that exists at that boundary of your device, you need to identify as a port and an interface. And
what are the port policies?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, SCSP is a critical security parameter. So these are all private symmetric keys and passwords. So anything that could, if exposed, could lead to a compromise in the security of the module is a critical security parameter. But not public keys. Public keys are not CSPs.
Yes, question.
If you're
using like an open source
crypt
library or making calls to open SSL, where would you draw your
So the good question. The boundary could be just the crypto library of OpenSSL. That's what SafeLogic has done. We have a crypto API that you plug in, you bundle OpenSSL around it, and our customers say, hey, we're using OpenSSL with a FIPS cryptographic library embedded inside. So that's providing all of the cryptographic functionality. That's where we decided to draw our boundary. The reason is OpenSSL makes updates every now and then. And we didn't want to maintain our cryptographic module every time that they have a new version release. So we drew that boundary small around the cryptographic APIs, because those are well-known algorithms. Those are math and stuff that aren't going to change. But TLS, that's going to change. There's going to be updates and fixes to TLS. And when we can just bundle that and provide that to our customers, they implement it in their product, the version of our crypto module hasn't changed. And that's how we have decided to pull our strategy and serve our customers.
So, what's the second one? Does that mean the software-based crypto
Yeah, there aren't any level 3, level 4 software modules overall. They can meet certain requirements, and no software libraries are going to be level 3 in ports and interfaces, because you're usually running on a general purpose computer. Those ports are shared, that Ethernet port is going to have keys and other data going over it, so it's not going to be physically separate. Remember, this was developed a long time ago, very hardware focused, and ports and interfaces is very, very hardware focused. So doing a software module, you have to talk about a logical boundary, which is that software boundary, and then the physical boundary being the computer, the physical box, because you don't really have ports on your logical. So you have to, the laboratory will describe the ports on the general purpose computer, for example, when you're doing a software.
The software boundary actually raises an interesting question. So, for instance, if you integrate OpenSSL, your keys will still be in a larger process, right? So they'll flow in and out of OpenSSL, but they're basically in one software process. So how do you make sure that your keys are secure both and outside the boundary?
This is the difference between a level 1 module, typically, and level 2 or higher module, is that software modules, you know, heavily used inside federal agencies, and they realize that, yeah, keys are going to exist in RAM, you know, in plain text. That's the nature of a software module, but it's still valuable because they trust the employee that owns the laptop that's creating a VPN connection or a TLS connection. So they're putting that trust in the employee themselves. One of my favorites is like these postal meters. You want to
give your customer a postal meter, so you put it to right on the customer facility, because you want to make sure that they run letters through and create stamps. But that customer could benefit by defeating the cryptography in that machine. So they're not necessarily trusted. And they're not an employee like a federal employee using their own laptop. So you want to have those higher protections. Typically, postal meters are validated at level 3 because you don't want people tampering with the crypto and dialing back the meter on them. So that's a stronger protection that you use for a reason because of the environment it's getting installed in. If it's getting installed in a federal building or a data center, level 1, level 2 is widely accepted.
So it's up to the vendor to decide, you know, this is the operating environment, therefore I only require level 1.
Right.
Or is there something in FIPS that when you validate a certain product, it also says something about it should be run in this kind of environment with these kind of security properties?
You could do that, but really in FIPS you have to describe how you're meeting the requirements for FIPS based on your cryptographic
technology. Yeah, put more acorns toward FIPS.
But that always comes up, you know, how are my keys managed? And, you know, that's an important question. That's why some people, you know, people that are updating their product frequently, that are software vendors, they'll have the small boundary typically, because they don't want to create a boundary around their whole product. They're going to add features and make updates to their product quite frequently and not change the crypto. So they want to have something that's easily maintained. One of the compromises is, yeah, maybe the keys aren't always protected in memory, but you assume you're on a device that's trusted by an individual that's trusted.
All right. We talked about roles, services, and authentication a little bit. The roles means an operator needs to be authorized to use the module. That could either be implicitly if there's no authentication requirements at level 1, or if they have a username password, that could be meet role-based or identity-based authentication requirements. Certainly, cryptographic keys for authentication would meet that identity-based because you've got it tied back to an individual identity. Entity. And so you just have to document the security strengths of that. It's pretty easy to meet the FIPS requirements for authentication. Services describe from your cryptographic boundary what is available to an operator of that cryptographic module. So if it's appliance, it may be, hey, I can do encryption, decryption, I can wrap and unwrap keys. Or if it's a crypto library, a software library, it may be, hey, I can do a RSA sign and verify type of activity there.
Yeah. So what's the difference between role-based authentication and identity-based authentication?
Probably the best way for me to answer that is give an example. So role-based would be, like, let's say you and I we're co-workers and we're both network administrators, okay? And we are using a device and we know the password. Our password is password 123 because we're lazy administrators. and so we can type password 123 into an IP address and we assume the role of administrator. So now that's role-based. I could do something, mess up an ACL list or something, and blame you, and there's no way for me to be shown that I was wrong. But identity-based would be if I had a username, so my last name, I type in my last name, my own personal password, that's tied to me, you have your own that's tied to you. So that would be identity-based.
Excuse me, but for level 3, it's not necessary that they actually use any authentication.
No, that's not true.
So
yeah, you have to authenticate to a crypto module at level 3.
You have to.
Yes. There has to be some way before a crypto module can provide cryptographic services.
an operator at level three who needs to authenticate. The one thing, if you're just merely asking for status, then you may not need authentication. There's no sensitive information coming out. But if you need to use crypto services at level three, the module has to authenticate.
So if the level three is simply a piece of hardware, simply say checking a signature, and then that's all it does when it's switched on. But there doesn't need to be any operator to be identified. So you would say that you can't get level three for that.
There are a couple of crypto services that you can provide unauthenticated access to, like hashing, for example.
Yeah.
But a verification, and anybody, any FIPS people in the room, you would need authentication to do a signature verification, because you're using crypto services. But SHA, you don't need to authenticate, and maybe some random, I think DRBGs you don't need to authenticate just to get some random bits. There are only two I can think of at the moment.
But anything that encryption, decryption, all of that, you would need to authenticate at level three. And there may be some sneaky ways that that happens. Behind the scenes, you don't realize it, but yeah, that happens somehow. I talked about the finite state model quickly. This is that high level diagram or table with descriptions to show that you're have all the required states that are required in the FIPS 140-2 publication. And then the lab uses this for testing. They'll use this during source code review or operational testing to exercise all of the documented states of the module.
Is this just
of
the module?
Yeah, they're a requirement for all cryptographic modules, the software modules. It's typically power on or instantiation, and then self-tests are run, and then services are available. Here's the crypto officer using services. Here's the user using services. Oh my, here we went into an error state because the conditional test failed. So it's really at that high level for software.
Okay, physical security is kind of fun to talk about. This is for a physical embodiment. We had a question earlier, can you tell what type of module it is? And you actually can. It gets listed on the website as a multi-chip or single chip or multi-chip embedded. Oddly enough, the software modules are listed as standalone, multi-chip standalone cryptographic modules. It doesn't indicate a software flag that you can tell. At level one, this is just making sure that people aren't using a breadboard in their garage making cryptographic modules, that you're using standard, production quality components. And there's this thing about maintenance role. Just don't define a maintenance role. Figure out people have a way to avoid that. Yeah, but this is just the basics of a hardware module, or every software module is validated at level one. A couple were validated at level two, but that's rare now. At level two, things get a little bit more interesting. You think about an appliance, like a hardware device. I have to make sure that I don't have easy visibility into components inside. That can be challenging, as Ray mentioned. If you're blowing air to cool things, you need fans and vents to do so. Also, you either need to have a lock, a pick-resistant lock, protecting the cover, or tamper-evident labels. And you think about the stickers on bananas or something. Those are easy to peel off and put back on. Nobody can tell what they are. Perhaps a gum wrapper where you actually have to open it up, and then if you put the top back on, you can tell that the gum wrapper was open. So they're looking, the lab is going to test these labels. They're going to apply heat, cold, solvents, but try to peel them off and stick them back on. If they can peel it off and stick it back on and not show any tamper had occurred, then that's a failure. But if they peel it off and put it back on, and it's clear that the stable issues is
label is just RIM or it says void or something like that, then that's a good label that will pass the requirements for tamper.
So what happens if the label is pulled out and a duplicate label is put back in? How does that qualify in this scenario?
That is out of the scope of FIPS.
I see. But won't it be a failure?
It's not a failure because they and one of the IGs, I believe, they say the introduction of new labels is out of scope.
Okay.
You basically assume that if someone has the labels, they have access to be able to have things.
It's not perfect. Some vendors will get specific logos printed on there. Some will even go as far as having unique serial numbers on each label and then maintain a log. So you can. There are people that certainly go above and beyond the FIPS requirements. That's not a bad thing.
If anybody needs labels, I know a guy.
Yeah.
I worked with the guy at Cisco. Freaking fantastic. So.
In the FIPS report itself, if the laboratory is completing that, section 4.5, physical security, doesn't apply to software modules. So this whole section is marked as not applicable. Level 3 gets more interesting. Single chip modules are often, they need level 3 just by design because you can't remove the packaging without destroying the chip itself. And if you scratch the chip, you can see tamper evidence. You're really not going to gain anything there. So it's very common that the packaging of a single chip is going to get a quick pass at level 3. So I always recommend trying to get level 3 for a single chip. And it's okay, it's usually hard. Clearly has tamper evidence. For multi-chip embedded or multi-chip standalone, and when I say multi-chip embedded, think of like a card that fills a slot to either a rack device or inside an appliance. That's a module that can be placed inside a larger device, and that embedded module is providing that cryptography. So multi-chip embedded at level 3, they're often done with either an enclosure or a clamshell type enclosure so you can't see anything, or covered with opaque epoxy that's hard, and if you try to chip it off, it's going to break off components and make that module no longer usable. And then standalones at level 3, you're looking at a strong enclosure, you know, production grade metal enclosure that's opaque, so you block the ability for a probe. And what's a good test if you're doing this yourself or working with a lab? Just take a paper clip and unbend it. And if you can poke in there and touch the memory and touch the processor, that's going to be a fail. But if you run into a wall and have to do memory degree, something like that, that's going to be a pass for physical security as far as the capacity and probe requirements of level 3.
So is that the 90-degree bathroom?
Yeah. So yeah, you make it hard, and you make it unreasonably hard for an attacker to do. I always think of the drill, because you're not allowed to take a sawzall or a drill and just drill through the enclosure at level 3. But if that's the easiest way to get to the stuff, it's probably a good design. The other thing at level 3 is that enclosure for a standalone module. If you open a cover or door, you need to have active zeroization. So there needs to be some sort of switch that will go and zeroize all of your keys, your passwords, all of those critical security parameters. Or you design it in such a way, if you remove a cover or door, just completely destroys the model. You're more of a mission impossible type of person who wants to blow it up in the smoke. Level 4 is interesting, but it's, like Ray said, there have been 2 level 4 modules done in the last 2 years, so there's not really many. And
very infrequent. I've helped complete hundreds of successful FIPS validations, and probably less than five of those have been level four. But at level four, now, if you do drill through the enclosure, it's going to actively zeroize the CSV. So that's kind of that envelope of protection there. So more than just the covers and doors. But you still have to meet all of those level one, two, and three requirements for opacity and all of that too. Just really type things down. Single chip modules can often need that because you try to get into that chip, it's going to break. But then with single chip modules, they can introduce any sort of solvents, any sort of high testing. It can be tough.
All right. Whew. I'm going to roll. Operational environment, this is section 4.6, and this applies to those software module libraries. So for a physical, a hardware device, this is not applicable, but for a software module, operational environment does come into play, and this usually talks about the operating system requirements. Normal operating systems satisfy a lot of these requirements here. And when you test on different flavors, Windows 2008, Windows 2012, if you've tested on both of those operational environments get listed on your FIPS certificate. There aren't any level 3, level 4 software modules.
The calling application is the user of this. Even though there are multiple physical people using the crypto, it might be just a single process that's the actual user.
Mark, I may have missed this. Did you say that operational environments only apply at level 1 and level 2?
Yeah, there aren't any level 3 or level 4 software modules ever registered in the program. It really talks about the operating system for a software module. So the environment in which the module runs in. So if you think about it, like a Windows 2008 would be the operational environment.
Okay, so what is the requirement?
The requirements are mostly satisfied by the operating environment, just a modern-day operating environment of keeping the memory separate and stuff like that. So one user doesn't have access to another user.
So this is maybe making sure that you are using an approved operating system or not.
Right. And in those operational environments for software modules will be used to vendors.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's what we were saying earlier with the software stuff. You have to specify something. And that's kind of where it's derived from.
EMI-EMC is a requirement that if you meet business use or home use, you have to test with a laboratory, get the proper certificates. Adds no security value, in my opinion, but it's in the requirement, so it's a requirement.
The unusual is that the home use requirement seems to be more stringent than the business use.
Yeah, because you can admit more in a data center than you want to admit at home. So. Right. Self-tests are required at power up. You need to have the sanity checks of your algorithm. So for example, you're implementing AES, you need to do an encryption, compare it to the expected ciphertext. If that passes, great. And then do a decryption, compare it to the expected plain text. Okay, you pass that self-test. And you need to do those for all of your approved algorithms. And they have to be run automatically, so it's not something where you can put up a prompt and say, would you like to run the self-test for FIPS? No, it has to be operator independent, so it has to do it automatically.
Can you go back?
Oh.
I was going to ask on the RNG test you looked at.
Right. There are also conditional tests, so as you're operating the module, maybe a cryptographic event occurs, like you generate some random bits. You need to do what are called the DRBG health checks now. You actually don't need to have a continuous random number generator test anymore. That's in the implementation guidance, so that's new. It used to be an absolute requirement. Now you can skip it because the health tests cover that. But if you generate public-private keys, you need to check for consistency in those keys that they can actually perform a sign and verify operation. And there's some bypass test, a firmware software load test, which means, hey, this image that I'm installing was actually signed by the manufacturer. Well, design assurance is section 10 in the requirements, and this has to do with your configuration management system. Build a materials list, all this gets dumped in here. Just make sure you have best practices for your software development lifecycle. Level 2, you need to have a functional specification and be able to have secure delivery. That means, hey, we use FedEx, we trust FedEx that it's getting there. It's not, you know, somebody driving an Uber car that delivers the module difference. At level 3, you're using a high-level language, and there are ability to have low-level languages if you're using it for performance reasons or something like that, so you can still meet level 3 with some assembly.
Question. What's the reason physically high-level you call assembly, or?
Yeah. Okay, a lot passes there. And then level 4, like I said, not many modules are done here, but you have to have a formal model, which is pretty academic experience and informal proofs and preconditions, postconditions.
There was one thing that probably came up in my mind when you were going to the self-test, and that was a challenge actually for me, but we overcame it. There was something called default entry point.
Yes.
In software implementations, when we boot the machine, the crypto library is supposed to be invoked at load time, and the user should not come into the picture to make any calls to the crypto library at startup.
Right. Yeah, and there's an implementation guidance about this. So a software module, when it gets instantiated in memory, it has to automatically run those self-tests.
Yes.
You can't have the application say,
yes,
run those self-tests. There used to be some guidance that allowed that. They've since shut that down. Yeah, I think it's easier to have that assurance. Like what you're talking about is very beginning. I can't do something very well.
So that doesn't prevent calls to going to the process of level instructions that you like, for example, NI or acceleration or storage acceleration, those kind of stuff. If you are relying on low level calls going to the process of acceleration library, that be not possible
with the
scope?
Yeah, you can, as long as you document where low-level languages are being used, then you can make an argument that this is the reason why it's used here. A high-level language is not available,
right,
this part of the process. So that is possible to still meet this. The last section is the mitigation of other attacks. This is just bragging rights if your module does something that you want to talk about, and like DPA protection from that or Tempest.
Mark.
Oh, another question. Sorry.
So if someone has a module, they're using a module, is there a revalidation required for adding mitigation against attacks?
Never had that come up, but I guess you could. That's interesting. It probably would depend, but I would lump that in with something else, you know, where you know you have to take out the maintenance.
Oh, like you mentioned, you know, 172.
Yeah. Because there wouldn't be much value in just adding it alone. Oh, Ray and I were worried that you wouldn't have any questions, but I think that worry has been calmed down now. So we have some hot topics that we've got here. Happy to go over any of these if these are high on your list. I know we're running short. Are we done at 12 or 12:30?
12:30.
Oh. Yeah.
12:20.
12:20.
You don't want to go to 12:30. So, what do you have to say on system 3? 12:20.
Rock and roll. Okay, question 3. What's the deal with entropy? Okay, yeah. Let's do
sounds
that.
Sounds like a sign problem.
Okay. What's the deal with entropy? Okay, Ray, I said I was going to do this. So let's talk about entropy a little bit. There are requirements now that you provide an entropy assessment report as part of your FIPS validation. The better information you provide in your FIPS lab, the easier it is for them. So maybe we'll look. Can we have a little fun? A little fun here? Okay, let's do a little bit of entropy.
Why hasn't been fun?
different type of fun. I mean, FIPS is really fun, but different type of fun. I know it's kind of nerve-wracking to volunteer. Would somebody like to volunteer? I promise I won't ask you any questions that, as long as you know a deck of cards, you can answer. Standard playing deck of cards. Somebody. Okay, thank you. I'm going to give you one of Ray Potter's books, just for the last one.
You got
it? Oh, okay.
Oh,
yeah. What's your name?
Rachel.
Okay, thank you, Rachel, for volunteering. Rachel, I'm going to have my invisible deck of cards here. So I would like you to pick out a card from the invisible deck of cards. Rachel, it's in the past. So go ahead and fan those cards out and can you turn them the other way so I don't want to see them. Okay. All right, Rachel. I would like you to just randomly, Rachel's our non-deterministic random number generator here. She's going to pick out a card to use as her key for encrypting her personal data. And because this is a private transaction, we have an invisible deck of cards. So Rachel, I want you to pick out a card. I'm going to give you some rules because aces, no. Don't pick any aces. Okay, those are boring. It's a standard deck of 52 cards, so no jokers. Cool. And Queen of Hearts, no. No on Queen of Hearts, too. Okay. So those five cards. Four aces, Queen of Hearts, no jokers. Rachel's going to pick this card. Are you happy with the one you selected here?
Yes.
Okay, do you want to change it?
No.
Okay. Rachel has picked that card, and I'm going to name it. That would be messed up, right? Because then your random number generator is pumping. Okay, are you ready? You can tell a lot from body language. So that's what I'm feeling here. Okay. Let me grab it. Got it, don't you? Chris.
No.
Yeah, what was my chance of guessing that right? Let's look at another example here, okay? I do have that deck of cards in the back here.
No, but by doing the condition that greens are not allowed, A's are not allowed, you have narrowed down the
point. I have. So I've got a deck of cards here with some names. I've got Tom, Stacy, and Bill, Amy, Gus, and everything. And you picked, what's your card that you able to guess Rachel's card, and that would have compromised. She didn't mind the diamonds, I think, for us.
Did you just get the chills there?
I got the chills just now.
Did you turn that over?
It's Chris. Very good. All right, so that would be a bad random number generator if I was immediately able to guess that. All right, I know I have a lot of smart people in this room. That was my kind of fun thing of going through and showing that, to me, the fifth requirement, the requirement state that the strength of the key is only as good as the strength of the entropy. So it's critically important in any security system that you have extremely strong entropy. And that is part of the FIPS process, is if you're generating keys, you need to have and understand well your source of entropy. Because if you are only getting 80 bits of entropy out of your non-deterministic random number generator, when you use that information to seed your deterministic random number generator, you can't just magically create more strength than that. So the amount of entropy that you have is extremely important in generating your cryptographic keys. Some questions there.
Why is it that we are emphasizing only an SP800-90ADRHE algorithm? There are so many random number generators available. Has it been theoretically proven that this is the most secure, because of which physicists mandating this to be used from now?
Yeah. So the question is, how come we've only limited key generation to the DRBGs and SP898. There are three of them there now, and those are the only FIPS approved random number generators, but you can use any random number generator to seed those. As long as you have sufficient entropy coming in, then you can create that the keys of your desired strength. So yes, you have to use one of the three DRBGs to generate keys. Metric keys, private keys, anything like that.
So what you're saying is that take a low entropy source, put it through some random number generator, use a seed, and then seed this. Is that what you're implying?
What's ideal is to gather entropy from one or more sources that contain, if you're generating 256-bit ADS keys and you want to claim 256 bits of strength, you need to show your laboratory and ultimately the CMP that the entropy you're collecting contains 256 bits before you're seeding it into your deterministic random bit generator. Because if you know what the seed is, like I knew for card, I'm going to be able to determine the key on the other side because it's a deterministic. Every time I have an input, I'm going to get an output on the DRPG.
So do we expect these SP
The SP898, those are NIST approved documents. So these are the only approved random number generators.
But they are special publications. They're not like NIST standards like FIPS.
Right.
So right. That's what I'm asking. Do you expect these like A, B, and C documents to be standard?
A
is standard, B and C are still in draft.
Right. Yeah, B and C are like draft one and draft two.
Yeah, no, I agree. It is confusing. I was hoping to get more information on those, but those have been in the draft for a while. But the algorithms are listed in the 90-day. And there is an ability to use other algorithms. If you're a fan of the NSA, they can provide algorithms for using a crypto model for generating keys directly.
I have a question on earlier part. So one of the earlier slides was showing the device and then detecting the device and detecting the implants. But where is that under the device? So the crypto module in doing crypto operations is detecting the keys. But if you have sensitive data on the wearable or something, where is that the earlier?
Okay. So the question was the earlier slide that showed the wearable, mobile phone, and the cloud server. We Ray had indications of protecting data in transit and then data at rest. What are the requirements?
Like in FIPS, what are the requirements? There are requirements on the module itself and on the key management.
Right.
But outside that module, there's getting those things. Maybe you're sitting in this thing, putting them right on top of it. Is that part of the requirements?
I'll try to help with that. So if you're using a FIPS model to protect data and you're using approved algorithms to do that, then if it's in ciphertext, it's considered protected. So whether it's sitting in storage or if it's in transit, that ciphertext is considered protected at that point. If you're not protecting it with FIPS approved cryptography, it's the same as plain text from this point of view. So even if you're using RC4 to encrypt traffic or encrypt data, it's considered plain text as far as the single piece. So the requirements are at the algorithm level. But if you have a TLS connection, then if that data in transit, you have to make sure you're using approved algorithms on both sides. It is possible to have a cryptographic module and not use it properly, right? But that's what you want to make sure that you're showing your customers that you are indeed using your cryptographic model properly.
But that's not the last job
There are ways to cheat through FIPS. You can do it if you want to. It's based on trust that you're telling the lab accurate information and the lab is telling the scene to be accurate information. So it's all a trust-based system. There's no specifics of, all right, you have to meet this root testing requirement.
Yeah, my question was
another question.
back to the development cycle. So how much do you get from the lab in the development cycle before you actually send someone to that study that helps? If you get prospectors or you get vital someone to do the
Yes, my tips, hot tips are engage early with your lab or your consultant, because I think they can provide the most value early in the process, especially physical security feedback. You don't want to find out right when you lock down the software that, oh wow, we can get in physical security and see these sensitive components. So that physical security you want to show early, even if you only have CAD diagrams, you want to share those with your lab and get some help on that. And then also, algorithm vector, sure, that can usually be done early in the process, especially if you're designing your own algorithm. You want to make sure you have ability to test it and that it's implemented properly. So those are a couple of things I recommend doing early. It's easy to change documentation. It's sort of easy to change software, but changing hardware will be very different.
Related question, so we were talking about conflict of interest earlier. At what point can a lab actually help you with early on in the process, like you say, with design choices, without that kind of clouding your independent business?
Yeah, just make sure, this is important because the labs are very good at not providing design guidance, because they see intellectual property from all of these different customers, and they have to be careful not to give Cisco secrets to Juniper, for example. You want to maintain those firewalls. But I always like to say the labs can lead you right up to the doorway. You have to make that step through. So they can talk about the requirements. They're very good at compliance consulting, so giving you guidance of, is the implementation you're proposing, will that meet the FIPS requirements? So they're extremely good at that. But you can't just say, okay, lab, why don't you design an enclosure that's going to meet level 3 physical security? And they can tell you, hey, based on what you have, you're going to need some temper solutions and stuff like that, but they can't tell you exactly the placement or specific vendors to use.
I don't know if anyone asked this question when I was doing TLS 1.3 in the works. How can FIPS get involved with TLS 1.3? Has that been talked about?
The question was about TLS 1.3 with that draft nearing finalization. How was that going to work with this? I think there's one thing that's not consistent with FIPS right now, and I was hoping this week to find out in which way we're going to go. This has always been extremely reasonable. They realize that TLS 1.3 is going to be widely used and heavily adopted. So I think that they just need to update the guidance to include, I can't remember if it was IDs or the way AES GCM was used in TLS 1.3, but I'm sure that they'll make an update to the implementation guidance that's compatible.
I'm also suspecting that they will update the key generation function, KDF. That's also the test vector stuff.
Yes. So there's a key derivation function as part of TLS 1.3 that would have to be in the algorithm test vector. Oftentimes what they do is they allow labs and vendors to vendor affirm to an algorithm before it's officially approved and made part of the algorithm testing program. And then later they'll provide algorithm testing for new algorithms. I absolutely believe that TLS 1.3 will be compatible with crypto models. Although some of the algorithms are going to do some cool algorithms like the cha-cha and and I'm a fan of those. Those are not disapproved, so you're not going to be able to negotiate a Cypress suite with those algorithms until they approve them.
Right.
But there are EES and GCM ones that you can use instead.
All right, so we have 5 minutes.
5 minutes?
5 minutes. How has this gone for everyone? Like, raise your hand if you got something out of it.
Cool.
Awesome. Raise your hand if you're happy you came. No, that's good. So is there anything we could have missed? Any last minute questions that you all have been, we were talking earlier, you guys have been awesome with the questions. Like, anything else you want us to go over really quickly? I mean, we'll be here all week, so you can ask us stuff anytime, but hopefully it's been pretty useful and valuable and everything like that. And like I said, there's a session after this that goes into some pretty detailed case studies, which should be pretty cool. So definitely check that out. And even if not everything is applicable to you, there's still some separate lessons learned there. Anything real quick? Yes. No, so all right, so containers. So we've been having this discussion with deployment via containers and deployment on AWS and things like that. So the challenge is that it hasn't been done, which from a startup perspective, we freaking love. We're like, all right, let's do it. But then the challenge that we start to see is labs and this are like, well, that hasn't been done. Right? So it does get to be challenging. So like Mark was saying, there's a couple of different ways to creatively work around some of the requirements and defining the operational environments, defining the delivery, defining all that stuff. So the long story short is we're still working on it. But right now there's no like, here is fit for Docker containing. Because it's just kind of working out in some ways.
Thank you.
Sure.
You mentioned that you want to get rid of some books as well.
Oh, we got one other book to get rid of.
I'll let you do that right at the end. I do want to say this is my absolute favorite tip in managing a FIPS project, and that is to perform a project pre-mortem. And most people know what post-mortems are, and they're a complete waste of time. If you're doing those now, just stop doing it, you know, save your staff the pain and agony of doing post-mortems. But a pre-mortem is at the beginning of a project, to say, all right, let's assume that this project ends in complete and utter disaster. What happened? How did we get here? And it's kind of a fun way to start a conversation. And you can hear from your FIPS lab, you know, what's important to your FIPS lab? Why would it end in a complete disaster from your FIPS lab's perspective? Or why would it end in a disaster from your vendor's perspective? Or why would it end in a disaster from your vendor, or from your own staff's perspective? And in the end of this slideshow, which will be available to all the attendees here, I have some references that go a little bit more into these project pre-mortems. I found them really valuable because you uncover things like, wow, communication is really important. You need to do that. A plug for Ray's book. I've actually read this cover to cover. I don't know if I've kissed up. Yeah, I don't know if I've kissed up to you in that. But I used to run a FIPS lab, and I'd make this mandatory reading for people that were new to FIPS and going through the FIPS training process. So even though Ray and Wes wrote it several years ago, it's very good. I did get a question too, and I'm going to make a shameless plug here. I went too fast. In my spare time, I created the FIPS Hacker Lab Report, so I have a website called fipshacker.com. I worked really hard on this lab report, which contains some of my tips of how to run a successful FIPS project. It also gives information on labs. I've received some real customer feedback on some of the labs, and you can go to my website there and there's a extra 15% off if your company wants to purchase that. I appreciate that. And then I have that couple of links on the project pre-mortem that will be available when you get this presentation. So with that, I'm turning it over to Ray, and you can
How are you going to randomly
get this? Why are you putting it on me?
We can do the birthday party.